sitting
life.
My table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like
justice.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Will.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solid,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 341. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and today I'm joined by Gord Barnes. And Gord and I are going to be touching on a number of different things, a bit of a review of situations in the world. But Gord, I think you wanted to talk about an upcoming event for Amnesty here that we're really excited about.
That's right, Jim. And also I'd like to welcome everybody who's tuning in, whether you're here in Regina listening over 91.3 FM or over the internet, welcome everybody to Human Rights Radio. We've got some very exciting news here in Saskatchewan to announce, and that is that on Saturday, October 19th, we'll be having the second annual Get Active with Amnesty Provincial Conference, the Saskatchewan Conference. We're going to have it this year in Moose Jaw at Zion United Church. And this follows the one we had last year in Regina that was very successful. It was at Luther College at the University of Regina. We decided this year to have it in Moose Jaw because we wanted to provide an opportunity to people in Moose Jaw, or at least more people in Moose Jaw than were able to come to Regina, but also people in other parts of southwest Saskatchewan to be able to get to Moose Jaw a little easier than perhaps Regina. It's not all that difficult for people to come in from other parts of the province either to Moose Jaw. It's actually a little closer for people who might be traveling from Saskatoon than it is to Regina. So we're very excited, appreciative of the fact that Zion United Church is providing the space to us for free that day. And we've got some great news in terms of who our keynote speaker is for the conference, who is also going to be involved in assisting with the panel presentation and some of the workshops. And that news is that we've confirmed that Alex Neve is going to be the keynote speaker. So maybe, Jim, if you wanted to share with our listeners a little bit about who Alex is, if they haven't heard him previously, and we can go on from there in terms of some of the other conference details.
Sure. Alex Neve has been Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada since January of 2000. He's been a member of Amnesty for 20 years, having joined when he was a student at Dalhousie University. He's worked for the organization nationally and internationally in a number of different roles, including research missions to Chad, Tanzania, Guinea, Mexico, Burundi, Colombia, Honduras, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Cote d'Ivoire, and Ghana. And he's appeared before various UN human rights bodies, Canadian parliamentary committees, and he has represented Amnesty International at numerous international meetings. He speaks and writes regularly in the national media on a range of human rights topics. Alex is a lawyer with a master's degree in international human rights law from the University of Essex in the United Kingdom and undergraduate commerce and law degrees from Dalhousie. He's practiced law in Toronto privately and in a community legal aid clinic, primarily in the areas of refugee and immigration law. He's taught international human rights and refugee law at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto and has been affiliated with the Center for Refugee Studies at York University. Prior to taking up his current position, he served as a member of Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board, and he's an officer of the Order of Canada. Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a really significant opportunity for anybody who might have an interest and curiosity about Amnesty International's human rights work to get a great introduction by attending the Get Active with Amnesty conference. Again, it's Saturday, October 19th. It'll start, we're going to have coffee and sort of a welcome at around 9:30, officially start the program around 10 in the morning, and then go throughout the day with a variety of workshops. As I mentioned, Alex is the keynote speaker. We're very pleased to be able to announce as well confirmation of a second member of the Amnesty International staff who will be attending and participating in the conference, and also assisting by presenting a few workshops, and that is Jackie Hansen, who's the current Amnesty International Canada campaigner for women's human rights. We're, as I say, very pleased that she's going to be able to join us. So people throughout the province have a tremendous opportunity to learn more about our work and find out how you can get involved. There's already some information posted. The easiest way to find that is just to simply go to our provincial website, amnestysaskatchewan.ca, and you could also check out our Facebook page at Amnesty International Saskatchewan. So I'd encourage everybody to save that date, October 19th, and mark it on your calendars and really take a look at attending if you possibly can.
Yep, for sure.
So, Jim, I think it's worth, after we've shared the news about the conference and are turning now to some of the various things that have been happening over the last couple of weeks around the world.
I'd just like to jump in one thing here, though. After all the description, we're talking about Alex.
Yes.
In addition to all that stuff I said, he's a great guy.
Yeah,
you know? We've spent time with him, and he's just a great guy to hang out with and spend time with.
Yeah, I think people will be very impressed with the work he undertakes and the conversations they have with Alex at the conference.
Yeah, sorry for jumping in there.
Oh, that's great.
But we're
worth noting.
We're going to be touching a number of bases here, and the one place where we're not really going to talk very much about is Egypt, and the reason being that is they're really in the news right now, and I don't think we can add very much to the discussion, and it's kind of an almost an hour by hour situation the way things are changing there.
That's right, Jim. You've really presented that well. In the last few days, the situation has become very, very serious, with the police now moving in on the protesters in Tahrir Square. The news reports are indicating that over 700 people have been killed in Tahrir Square, and there's a significant amount of violence and, if you could, literally chaos in other parts of the country. We're very concerned. Amnesty International is about how this is developing. Actually, earlier this week, before the police moved in, Amnesty International actually issued a call for the Egyptian authorities not to precipitate a situation that was obviously going to provoke a large number of deaths, and very, very concerned about what's happening. One of the things that the international community needs to look at very, very seriously is to stop the flow of weapons into Egypt in a current crisis like this, where there are so many human rights violations mm-hmm. taking place. We really need internationally to limit the supply of arms, and this is an opportunity for the international community to come to the table on that.
For sure, for sure. I think that what makes it so deadly is that nobody seems inclined at this point to have a conversation, to do any discussing. Everybody is right, and they won't budge, and they don't want to talk.
Yeah, and the human rights crisis is significant.
Yeah.
So I think, Jim, we were going to probably leave it at that relative to the just simply noting that this is a significant concern with respect to what's going on in Egypt, and turn now to reflection on something actually that happened about 40 years ago now in Chile. And
When you talk to Chileans about 9/11,
yeah,
they have a different 9/11 that they mark.
Right. So do you want to take it away with a bit of a background around that, and some information that you might share with our listeners there about what happened on September 11th, 1973, and some of the sort of aftermath of that?
Yeah, it's almost 40 years ago now. The General Augusto Pinochet's coup d'état in Chile, and Amnesty is issuing a series of features highlighting stories of some of the women and men who survived torture and those still searching for their missing loved ones. During the Pinochet rule in Chile, human rights activist José Zalacuet was twice arrested and ultimately forced into exile. As a committed lawyer, he was a target of government attempts to stop him from defending human rights. Here he shares his story and thoughts of what the figure of Augusto Pinochet means today, and we have that video. So maybe we should go into that, Gord.
Yeah, no, that's...
I think that's the video I have, isn't it?
Might be worth just leaving that for a bit and carrying on with some of the information relative to that story specifically, Jim. And,
oh, okay. Alrighty. Yeah. Oh, I see what's going on here. We have a transcript.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay, well, when Augusto Pinochet seized power in Chile 40 years ago, law professor José Zalacuet was lecturing at the Universidad de Chile. Even though the news didn't surprise him at the time, the days that followed seemed more like a film script. And in quotes, he says, "We could see the coup coming. It was like an announced Greek tragedy where everybody knows the end, but you cannot avoid it," he said. As Pinochet was taking power by force, Zalacuet, his then wife and two young daughters, left their home with a few possessions and went to live in relative safety with a friend on the outskirts of the city. There they spent hours gathered around the television watching events unfold, including the death of President Allende, and the statements of the new authorities publicly promising to eradicate the Marxist cancer in Chile. And shortly after taking office, the military authorities published lists of people they were looking to arrest. Jose's boss appeared on the first. Undeterred by the potential threat to the safety of both himself and his family, a few months after the coup, José joined the Comité Pro Paz. It was a new church-based organization that took on the risky job of documenting abuses and providing legal aid to detainees and their relatives. José was in charge of collating information about hundreds of detained or missing men and women. Events unfolded rapidly and life for Chileans became almost unrecognizable. Political parties and trade unions were banned, detentions of activists escalated, and a curfew was imposed, meaning that no one could be seen on the streets between midnight and 6 a.m. And in quotes, the military government imposed a very severe control. If you were on the street between those times, you could be shot. People detained were immediately taken to centers across the country, some of them secret. Around 18,000 people ended up in the Estadio Nacional, one of Chile's largest football stadiums that was refurbished to accommodate large numbers of people. At the same time, the Pinochet regime established the DINA, a unit of secret political police in charge of carrying out systematic arrests and abuses against those seen as opposing the regime. People were kidnapped from their homes, at the workplace, or in the street, sometimes never to be seen again. As the number of people arrested and disappeared grew, relatives of the missing began approaching lawyers such as José, asking for help. Even though there was little he could actually do, José began accompanying the relatives of those held at the Estadio Nacional. They would form long lines to leave food and clothes with the soldiers, hoping they would reach their loved ones. And he remembers, "People need to know there's a lawyer in charge. It gives them spiritual peace knowing that they are doing everything they can for their loved ones. The military didn't like what we did, but for a while we were protected by the various churches." And that's him in quotation. For 2 years, he worked tirelessly helping political activists find asylum in local embassies and eventually secreting them out of the country. However, when he was woken up by a loud knock on his door at 1:30 a.m. on a warm night, it came as no surprise. José knew he was a perfect target. And in quotes, "I remember I told my wife to stay calm, and I went to the bathroom and took a Valium to control my nerves. There was every chance that I was going to be interrogated when they took me." This is what he was telling Amnesty International. Behind the door, a group of police officers were waiting. In the course of a week, he says, a total of 22 people from his organization were arrested. José was held in detention for 2.5 months. He was questioned but not tortured. However, on his release, he was told to leave the country. He had no intention of doing so, and after just 13 days of freedom, he had another visit from the police. And in quotes, "The civilian police asked me where I wanted to go, and I said, nowhere. So they took me prisoner and held me for 12 days. End of quote. He believed it was all because he didn't get the message to stop the first time around. José left Chile with two military officers walking him all the way to his plane, where they sat him down and buckled his seatbelt. He moved first to France and then to the USA, where he joined Amnesty International and a number of other Chilean exiles working to raise awareness of the human rights situation in the South American country. He was president of the organization's International Executive Committee and later Deputy Secretary General. It would take 15 years of exile before José could return home to his country. In 1990, Pinochet was ousted as a result of a referendum in 1988 that led to national elections and a new democratically elected government taking office in March of that year. Subsequently, José sat as a key member of the Rettig Commission that was charged with looking into the extent of the human rights violations that had taken place under the military regime. He says that even though challenges remain, things have changed for the better. Partly as a result of his work, 160 police and military personnel have been arrested for their part in Pinochet-era abuses. These and many others are currently facing trial. And our final quote, in Chile, no one argues about what happened. The newspapers that supported the military regime stopped talking about the alleged disappeared, and now they talk about the disappeared. And even private TV channels show documentaries depicting events at that time. The truth is no longer a matter of debate, he says. Today, Pinochet is a bad memory. He was the visible face of a junta that governed for 17 years. It's a reprehensible stigma for the country and the world.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jim. I just wanted to mention as well that on the Amnesty International website, there's also a report from Roger Plant, who joined Amnesty International in 1972 to cover the work of the organization on Latin America. And it wasn't long after that, after the Pinochet coup, that he went to Chile and documented the arbitrary detentions, torture, and disappearances. I'm not going to share all the details of that because of time here, but we did want to reference some of the history there, where in terms of the conversations he had with the late Martin Anhals, who was Amnesty International Secretary General, senior staff person for the international movement. When he wasn't allowed, sure if he would be allowed into the country, he was able to get there, and fortunately was able to document some of the stories and reports of people who had been disappeared, who had been tortured, and that was a very, very important report that he was able to write. He did that and released all the information that he had available to him, and it drew attention to what Pinochet was involved in. And at that time, Pinochet, it should be noted, was getting a significant amount of support in the U.S. And from the United States, and the human rights violations there were just terrible. So I think, Jim, you were going to share a video and you gives another person telling their story about what happened in Chile.
Okay, it starts off with a little wee bit of music here, but then it goes right into the interview here.
Great.
Sus miradas, hay soldados también, y no su dolor, porque desprecian.
When Pinochet came to Europe, and is when they said Pinochet has been arrested in the London clinic around 11 o'clock p.m. and so on. So the following day, we started to see what we could do in order to hold him first, and secondly, perhaps to extradite him to Spain. Then the full amnesty machinery started to work, you know, campaigning in the streets and all over the world. They started to say, well, we want Pinochet to get put in trial. It was not enough with three demonstrations. We had to go to court, and for the first time, we could give information. Our legal team produced the case whereby he is guilty, or probably guilty, of crimes against humanity. He could not have any kind of immunity. It was great. Imagine a person from who was in this country was going to be extradited to Spain for crimes committed in a third country. And that was the universalization of justice that started now to be, you know, something totally recognized. I have said to the mothers, not only the mothers of Chile, but other mothers, no, or disappeared or victim sent, that we will be with you to the end of the world, to the end of time. We will not leave you alone.
Well, that turned out to be a little shorter than what we were expecting. So we got some music from Delhi to Dublin that we're going to play after the break. Let's go to the break here right now.
So that's Delhi to Dublin, and if you ever get a chance to see them live here in Regina, they were here a few weeks ago for the India-Canada Association celebration of India's independence. It was an anniversary event they have every year, and I was very fortunate to attend the concert. Regina is very fortunate to have a large population of people from India, mm-hmm. and it was a really wonderful concert, and also they had a great celebration throughout the afternoon. you know, the Delhi to Dublin's been in Regina a couple times. Prior to that, I know at least at the Exchange and the Folk Festival, their music is hard not to get up and dance to.
Oh,
so
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Good stuff. So I recommend them. And I thought we'd maybe turn now to a different region. We were in the first part of the program sharing information about Amnesty International's reports with respect to Chile and some of the work we undertook over 40 years ago now relative to the human rights crisis that happened there under the coup that was led by Pinochet. And, you know, there's going to be a lot more information available on that situation, the anniversary of the coup in the next few weeks. But I wanted to take a little bit of time, Jim, to reference another report that Amnesty International has released just in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with respect to Nigeria, obviously a different region of the world. And what it is new evidence from actually satellite images that reveals the true extent of the forced eviction of people in Lagos in Nigeria, one of Africa's two mega cities. And the pictures were taken before and after demolitions carried out in Lagos State by the government in February 2013. And they clearly show that a densely populated area containing concrete houses and other structure was literally razed to the ground. And it's estimated that close to 9,000 residents of that area lost their homes or livelihoods. And, you know, the significant thing is that senior officials in the state government have claimed that the area was simply a rubbish dump. However, the effects of the forced eviction has been devastating on the community there, where many people are still now sleeping out in the open or under nearby bridges, exposed to rain, mosquitoes, and the risk of physical attack. Amnesty International has issued a new report on the consequence of the demolitions and documenting the failings of the state government, the local government there, and calling for assistance to be provided to people who have been displaced as a result of the demolition of that neighborhood. There's a lot of detail, as I mentioned, on the Amnesty International website. We'd encourage people to check it out and really take a look at what's happened in that country. I want to just, before we move on to the next portion and or the next country, make one note, though, and that is on a positive, very positive development with respect to Nigeria. Nigeria, the news is that Nigeria is actually now the very first African country to sign on to the Arms Trade Treaty. And that is really good news. Mm-hmm. And we want to acknowledge that you know, while on the one hand, Amnesty International has obviously got concerns with respect to what's happened in terms of the forced evictions of large numbers of people. In the one hand, the fact that the Nigerian government is leading the way and providing an example to other African countries to sign on to the Arms Trade Treaty is very positive. And we're going to be continuing to campaign to get governments around the world, including the Canadian government, to ratify the Arms Trade Treaty, to sign on so that it becomes a legally enforceable instrument that we can use to advance our human rights work. And I think probably in the interest of time, Jim, we should probably move on to the next region or country, not region, but at least country. And you were going to share some information with respect to what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC.
Right, right. And this is an article by Audrey Gogren, who's the Director of Global Issues at Amnesty International. And she's just left Katanga in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, where her colleague Lisa Tassi and her were following up on Amnesty International's work on mining and human rights in the region. And they, as far as they're concerned, in some ways this is easy to do. Besides mining, mostly of copper and cobalt, precious little happens in southern Katanga. But two very different methods are employed to extract these minerals. One method is industrial mining that involves large multinational companies, and it's managed from air-conditioned offices and carried out with heavy equipment. And the other method is small-scale artisanal mining, and it's frequently done in sweltering heat by men and in some cases boys under the age of 18 working with basic tools. Artisanal mining can be a desperate business. On top of suffering harsh work conditions, many creusers, meaning diggers, as the miners are known locally, they're ruthlessly exploited by traders who buy from them along a largely opaque supply train. In theory, the state has some oversight of the system, but the reality is quite different. And earlier this year, Amnesty published a report exposing the conditions, and one of the things that they tried to examine on their return visit is where the minerals from such sites as Tilwazembe actually end up. And key to that are traders. But the supply chain to take the minerals mined by cruisers out of Katanga is complex. It operates with virtually no oversight and no meaningful paper trail to enable minerals to be tracked from source to export. So the bottom line is it's a very convoluted system that really ends up with the human rights of these workers largely being ignored. And you can imagine working in that kind of heat with oppressive heat and probably dangerous conditions. Mining is not a particularly safe. Well, let's say it has its hazards that and risks that have to be managed. And if you're mining in a context such as you're going to find in Saskatchewan, the risks are identified and they're dealt with and it's made as safe as possible. So you can imagine a situation where they're basically doing the work by hand, and risk management is up to the individual, and it's a very dangerous type of enterprise. Anyway, the traders they sell to others inside Katanga, where the ore is processed or not necessarily, before being sent out of the country, often by the truckload across the Zambian border. Export paperwork gets filled out and filed, but by this stage in the process, the origin of the minerals has already been obscured. The life of a cruiser is harsh. The Congolese authorities can and must do more to protect people from exploitive and harmful working conditions. But those who buy the ore along the supply chain can also make a difference. If they insist on knowing from which sites the ore or minerals come and the conditions on site and the conditions under which it continues to be traded, key questions need to be asked and information verified. However, this kind of due diligence is impossible if there's no proper recording and oversight. So efforts to ensure fair work conditions for cruisers have to take account of the fact that there is practically no other livelihood on offer to many Katanga residents. The answer is not to prevent artisanal mining, but to make it a safer and fairer business until longer-term solutions are found. That's it for Katanga. Gord, you were going to, you've got something on Bangladesh.
That's right. We're now shifting to another, in this case, another region of the world. And Amnesty International has expressed significant concern with respect to the recent arrest of a very prominent Bangladeshi human rights defender. This happened without a warrant on August 10th. Amnesty International believes he's a prisoner of conscience and has adopted, in this case, his name is Adilur Rahman Khan, and he was detained solely for peacefully challenging alleged human rights violations by the Bangladesh security forces. His arrest really is going to send a chilling message to other government critics in Bangladesh, and the message is clear: if you raise your concerns about human rights, there will be serious consequences. We're calling for the immediate release and unconditional release of this human rights defender and others who have been detained. He's actually the secretary of a Dhaka-based human rights organization, and the police have actually also seized computers and other equipment in their office. He's been very critical of the security forces' actions during protests earlier this year by an opposition group back on May 5th and 6th, and at least 44 people were killed during the protests by police. We're hoping that the international pressure can be brought to bear on the Bangladeshi government to release this human rights defender, and wanted to draw attention to this particular case for our listeners. Again, you can find out lots more about that on the Amnesty International website. So, Jim, I guess it's worth, in the interest of time, to take a moment, and you can share a bit of information about Syria in terms of new reports about what's happened there and the mass displacement that's been going on.
Yeah, we have a couple of sort of first person reports from a couple of people. One of them is from a 15-year-old boy, Hussein Al-Sagir. He's in telling Amnesty about his 16 relatives who were killed in a ballistic missile strike in the Jabal Abadro district of Aleppo on the 18th of February of this year. And he says, "All my extended family lived here. We had 10 houses. My mother was badly injured and is now in hospital in Turkey. She does not know that her sons are dead. My uncle, Muhammad Ali, lost 27 members of his family. He's lost his mind. He doesn't know anything anymore. He is in the countryside. Everyone who survived has gone to stay with relatives or friends somewhere. Here, there is only rubble left." And another first-person account, Sarah Al-Wawi, who lost some 20 relatives in an airstrike in the Al-Marjaz area of Aleppo on the 18th of March. And she says, Yusef, 7, Mohammed, 5, Ali, 2, Hamza, 12, Zahra, 10, Husna, 8, Fatima, 10, Ahmad, 7, Abdel Karim, 2, Hassan, 18 months. Why did they bomb here? There were only civilians here. Our quarter was full of life, children playing everywhere. Now we are all dead, even those of us who are alive are dead inside. We have all been buried under this rubble. A very, very, very sad state of affairs there. And satellite images of Aleppo are providing the most recent evidence of how the protracted conflict in Syria is resulting in massive human rights violations against the civilian population, which is bearing the brunt of the spiraling violence and displacement and humanitarian crisis. The new analysis, one of the most comprehensive satellite image analyses of an active conflict zone to date, shows alarming trends in how the conflict is being fought with utter disregard for rules of international humanitarian law, and they're causing extensive destruction, death, and displacement. It's a very disturbing description of what's going on there.
One of the significant pieces with respect to Syria, and again, this is where the international community really needs to look at what's happening and figure out a way to end the violence. Obviously, one of the significant ways is to end the transfer of weapons by all sides or to all sides of the conflict. But one of the significant pieces around this is the large-scale number of refugees that are having to flee Syria. In one case, there's a refugee camp in Jordan, neighboring Jordan, just 12 kilometers south of the border of Syria, where now there's over 130,000 refugees.
Yeah, that's close to the population of Regina, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You know, that's, and they're living in what is literally a lifeless desert plain, in a mix of makeshift emergency tents, mobile homes, or caravans, and it's just terrible conditions for people to have to live in. It's creating enormous pressure not only on Jordan, but other countries in the region, including Turkey, Lebanon, and fueling conflict even within those countries. People have actually, even though there's conflict still in Iraq and Egypt, many people have fled as well to both of those countries. And the hope is that very soon the international community will find a way to bring pressure on the people who are involved in the conflict there and bring an end to the significant human rights crisis in Syria.
The more you look at the situation there, it's absolutely heartbreaking, and you wonder how the government can continue doing what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you also wonder why the international community seems to be powerless to intervene,
mm-hmm.
and in some meaningful way. I guess we can only hope that the international community, the United Nations, can somehow go in and make a difference. But right now, the situation there is absolutely desperate.
So, Jim, I thought maybe we should now turn to yet another region of the world and just note that we had some positive news with respect to Guatemala, and actually there's a Canadian connection here just recently, and that is on July 22nd, Amnesty International welcomed the precedent-setting decision by a Superior Court justice in Toronto. The justice affirmed that claims that have been brought by 13 Guatemalan indigenous people against the Canadian company Hudbay Minerals and its subsidiaries should be permitted to go to trial. And Hudbay and its subsidiaries had attempted to prevent the claims from going forward, arguing that a parent corporation can never be held liable for murders, shootings, and rapes allegedly committed by security personnel employed by a Guatemalan subsidiary. This is good news in the sense that finally there will be an opportunity in a Canadian court for people who really have significant grievances about what has been happening in Guatemala as a consequence of a Canadian mining company. Amnesty International actually intervened at the hearing in March of this year when the companies tried to stop the claims from going forward. At the hearing, there were two lawyers that represented Amnesty International, and they argued that a parent company does owe a duty of care to people who may be harmed by conflict and the conduct of its own subsidiary companies. And legally speaking, in Canada, individuals and corporations do have an obligation to take a reasonable care to avoid conduct that entails an unreasonable risk of harm to others. And in light of that, there are international standards with respect to corporate behavior that Amnesty International has argued that should apply in an instance like this. So, again, it's a positive development that court case will be able to proceed for the plaintiffs involved. We don't have a lot of time to share all the background, but certainly wanted to draw people's attention to that report.
That's a wonderful positive development for sure.
Another piece more locally that we just wanted to reference before the end of the program is the video that's been produced. It's called One Year, One World, the farewell ceremony, and actually relates to a First Nation in British Columbia. And it's a project that was undertaken because a large gold and copper mine is now under construction on the lands of these people where they traditionally hunted, fished, trapped, and gathered berries and medicine. And it has displaced people. There was no consultation with the people with respect to the decision of the government to open the mine. And they recently held in this instance, a sacred ceremony to, first of all, pray for their land and also for the safety of the mine workers. The farewell ceremony in the video tells a moving story of a community that is determined still to protect their culture and way of life. We'd encourage everybody to check out that video. And just as a bit of background, in 2008, there was a Colorado-based company called Thompson Creek that received permits from the BC government to proceed with mining of copper and gold deposits that were located in the traditional lands of this particular First Nation. There was once a healthy forest cared for by the First Nations community who lived there, and today it's an open pit mine, and it's just weeks away from extracting resources. So I think in the interest of time, we've got to take a moment and just share something that we did at the very beginning of the program, and that is the news with respect to an exciting conference we're going to be holding in Saskatchewan, in Moose Jaw, October 19th. It's called Get Active with Amnesty International. We're encouraging everybody to take a look at that. We're very pleased, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, that Alex Neave, the Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada, will be attending. The conference is free for people to attend, a great way to learn more information about Amnesty International's work. We're also very, very pleased that Jackie Hansen, the Women Human Rights Campaigner for AI Canada, will be attending and assisting with some workshops. Be a great way to meet other human rights activists and learn more about our work, and encourage everybody to take a look at attending. Moose Jaw is a kind of a neat place for people in terms of other opportunities for visiting and tourism and checking out an interesting part of our province. A lot of history there.
They got a great Western Development Museum there.
Yeah, so we'd encourage everybody to mark that date, save that date, October 9th, and put it on your calendar for sure.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it, Gordon. We had a great time last year, and glad to see it moving to Moose Jaw this year, and who knows where next year.
Right. So I think we're probably close to the end of the program schedule here, are we?
Yes, we are. So we'll wrap it up, and we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope that you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."